Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another movie podcast courtesy of BBC Radio 5 Live. Mark is here.
Hello, Simon.
And also, I have to tell you that an extremely privileged audience, the elect of London indeed, have made it into the Phoenix Cinema in East Finchley, and they would like to say hello to you podcast listeners. Say hello.
Hello!
Mark, what's coming up in the next long podcast thing?
Reviews of The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, Don't Call It Wall Street 2, Town Called Panic, and much, much more, including a guest appearance by...
Aaron Sorkin, of course. We're at the Phoenix Cinema. Do you want to explain why we've come to London?
The reason we're here is because this is the cinema that I pretty much grew up in. I used to live down the way from here, and this is the cinema that I came to see all the films that were important to me when I was a teenager. Actually, when I first started coming here, it was the Rex Cinema, and they used to do, during half terms, they used to do double bills. I remember one half term coming here to see Titchfield Thunderbolt, Man in the White Suit, Passport to Pimlico, Lady Killers, I think, and it became the cinema that I went to as a kid, and then the Rex was reborn as the Phoenix. And on Friday and Saturday nights here, they had late nights of, you know, cult movies. So it's here where I saw Exorcist, Shivers, all the Cronenbergs, all the Khodorovskis, David Lynch. I always sat in exactly the same seat. I mean, actually, funnily enough, they've changed the seating slightly, although the seating plan is vague. There used to be an aisle down that way. But where I used to sit is exactly where that camera is there now. So... Oi, you, get out of my seat. Because I always had to sit in the same seat, which is on that aisle, the left-hand aisle, because I don't do trapped seating, as you know. So I saw pretty much every important film from that aisle. And it was in that seat, sitting next to my friend Nick Cooper, that we saw Eraserhead. That was the seat that I sat in. I saw The Exorcist for the first time from that seat. And I sat next to Nick Cooper, who sat all the way through Eraserhead, which he didn't enjoy at all. And as he didn't enjoy it, his leg... started vibrating. The new seats probably don't do this, but it used to be that if you sat in one of those seats and you vibrated your leg, the entire row would go like that. And he really wasn't enjoying the film, and halfway through he turned to me at a crucial moment when Henry, this guy, the film's made in black and white, has brought home an alien baby which he may or may not have fathered, which he's looking after on his own, and there's a woman in the radiator singing to him while strange extraterrestrial creatures fall out of the sky. And Nick Cooper turned to me and said the stupidest thing anyone has ever said in the cinema. He turned to me and went, well, that wouldn't happen.
So was it in the cinema where your insecure, obsessive behaviour started?
Yeah, and continued, in fact. Continued very thoroughly.
Why did you always have to sit in the same seat? What kind of...
I liked that seat. There wasn't a camera in it at the time.
It's exactly the same as that seat.
No, it's not. It's not. You see, if somebody was sitting there right now, which they can't, because it's interesting, right? When they had to set up a camera, they looked for the prime place in the cinema, and it's interesting that that's where they settled for.
You see, that's
that
a
different
there,
camera.
And the other camera
they
there.
They haven't taken seats out to get that camera where that one is.
Bill, somewhere near Cambridge, I really hate to bang on about the state of your relationship again, but it's causing me no end of grief. I've got a 9-year-old on my hands who thinks that arguing at any opportunity is great because of, quote... those two men you like on the radio, Dad. You know, the nice one and the loud one.
Oh, he means Radcliffe and McConey, not us.
Best behaviour, please.
Very good.
Says Bill. It occurs to me there's a man in a red T-shirt sitting right next to you, and he's probably Paul Homer, chief executive of the Phoenix Cinema Trust. We should say hello.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Mark. Hello, Simon.
Say hello to Paul.
Hello.
How you doing?
I'm well.
It's like
thank you.
Alcoholics Anonymous meeting.
You're Paul and you run this cinema. Tell us about the Phoenix. 100 years old and you've done a whole lot of refurbishment.
Yeah, we just reopened 4 weeks ago after spending the best part of £1 million completely restoring it, bringing it back up to the kind of the beauty that it had in the 30s, putting a new cafe, bar in, just making it really, really wonderful again.
What did the £1 million go on? What was the most expensive thing that you spent that cash on?
Fire alarm systems are expensive, but pretty boring.
That's a bit disappointing.
Yeah.
Thing,
can you pretend that it was the balcony? Then we can talk about the balcony.
The balcony
was where most of the £1 million went. Because it is fantastic. One of the problems with the Phoenix before was that it was a lovely place, but it didn't have like a cafe area. So when you come out of a film, the thing you really want to do is to have a chat with somebody, or, you know, have an argument about, or have explain to them why they're wrong about the film, right? And actually, what you'd have to do is go to one of the local pubs, some of which are great, some of which are a little insalubrious. Now you can come out of here. You can not only can you go straight into this lovely cafe area, but you can, if you so wish, go straight out onto the balcony and Mussolini-like explain to East Finchley what's right or wrong.
It appeals to the megalomaniac.
It does, yes.
So do you pick and choose here, Paul, as to the movies that you get? Are you a blockbuster movie house, or are you an art house cinema?
You could call it art house. It's very much about showing what we think is the best film of any given week. So we've been showing Winter's Bone and Made in Dagenham recently. We've got another year coming up, the new Mike Leigh film. In fact, what's interesting about the Phoenix is we just put a whole range of stuff on. In this one week alone, Friday to Thursday, we've got 10 different films and broadcasts going on, including the show, which for one-screen cinema is pretty incredible. I mean, you look at multiplexes, they'll put the same film in five screens. We kind of completely turn that on its head and have a wider range as possible.
The other thing the Phoenix has, which is becoming an increasing rarity, is a projectionist who stands by the projector and puts the film through it and makes sure that it projects. As I read now that there's some multiplex chains have decided to do away with projectionists altogether and just have the managers press go from a central box, which, as anybody who's seen a film being badly projected in a multiplex will know, is not the desired experience.
Who is your projectionist? Is he called Eric?
No, it's called Pete. Well, there's a couple, but the our kind of famous projectionist is a guy called Peter Bailey, who's worked here since 1960. So he's been here 50 years, and he's just announced his retirement. So that's that's worth a round of applause.
Steve on this email says, my local cinema, let's call it World of Cine, has decided that it's no longer enough to just watch a film in the cinema, the idea of it, and that you now have to gorge yourself on nachos, popcorn and 14-gallon Cokes. To help with this fattening of the cinema watchers' waistlines, they have actually shut the box office at the front of the cinema, and you now have to buy your tickets at the confectionery stand. There'll be a number of people nodding at this point. Queue various times when I have queued with my unlimited card behind people buying their body weight in popcorn, or worse, students digging around in multiple pockets trying to dig out a hidden NUS card for their discount whilst I watch the minutes count down to the film starting. To me, this new approach is an insult to people who just want to watch a film, and its only design is a soulless money-making exercise for you to queue up for your 15 to 20 minutes before deciding, you know, I'm here, I might as well have insert various food items. To save future generations of cinema goers from telling their kids of the good old days when you could just buy a ticket, please bring this to people's attention and hopefully we'll sway the chain to cease this approach. What is the buying experience that you have for us here, Paul?
Well, that guy could choose to go somewhere else, right? I mean, if he hated it so much, he could just not go to that cinema.
He could move to East Finchley.
He could move to East Finchley, yeah. Yeah, we sell popcorn. Hands up on that one, really sorry. People like popcorn.
But can you buy your tickets at a ticket stand?
You can, but you could also buy a ticket at the bar if you want to. So there's the options to do what you want to do.
Do you understand the frustration of people who don't want to queue behind 10 or 15 people who are buying snacks?
Yeah, of course. But at the same time, to kind of put a commercial angle on it, and not that I'm defending the World of Cine, but
whoever they might be.
You
may have a view on that. I was just spreading the blame, you know.
But, you know, if you've only got one queue of people waiting, then the theory is, I guess, that you serve people quicker, but that might not actually be happening.
Demonstrably. The thing, the way it used to be with the Phoenix was there used to be one person, there was a little tiny little kiosk, but the refreshments that were sold were a little thing of instant coffee. And the guy had to actually make the instant coffee, so that did take quite a long time.
Yeah.
Isn't another cinema experience from Joseph Bridges in Dayton, Ohio. Avid listener to the program, excuse me, I rarely go to a movie in the theatre. I decided to treat myself for my birthday, and I saw Let Me In, since I really like the original. I can see what you mean when you say you would like all the seats around you, Simon. I was treated to, this is to you, Mark, three people giving a laugh track at every instance that there was nothing on screen which would be laughable. Two, a complete commentary from the man behind me saying how much he did not want to see this movie in the first place. And three, a crying baby. This makes three out of three times that I've been to a movie in which a baby cried the whole movie in the last 2 years. I pine for the day I can afford a theatre of my own just so I can watch a film in peace. Do you let babies in?
We do.
Can you say that in any more?
Do you hate babies?
Babies in. Let babies in here.
Are you anti-babies?
No, not at all. Do you understand that cinema experience?
We have a specific show for babies, for mothers and babies. They don't tend to come on their own. on a Wednesday morning at 11 o'clock. So because I think you were talking about something on your show the other week, you know, just because someone's had a child doesn't mean that they've had a lobotomy. They want to watch interesting films, so we provide that for them. But we try to encourage them to not bring their babies at other times.
Since you mentioned it in that email, do you want to ask me what I thought of Let Me In?
No. Okay, what did you think of Let Me In?
Well, I don't want to preempt the review, obviously, Simon, but what I would like to say is that Let the Right One In is a film about children that happens to have vampires in it, and Let Me In is a film about vampires that happens to have children in it.
Good, thanks for that. Paul, entice us with future wares here at the Phoenix.
Yeah, really busy programme, and I said lots of things going on. Always kind of new release and films coming on. On Sunday afternoons, we do lots of archive screenings. We've got a season called A Century of Cinema, where you can sit in this auditorium and see the experience that you would have had if you'd come here in the 1920s and the 1930s. We've got Buster Keaton's General in here on Sunday afternoon for the 20s. We've got King Kong next month for the 30s. That's a wonderful season. We also do live broadcasts. So we do the New York Met Opera live. So that's performing in New York, where people are watching it live on this screen.
And you had the Stephen Fry show here, didn't you?
Did the Stephen Fry show, yeah.
You've got a play coming from the National Theatre next week.
We have, yeah. We've got Complicity's Disappearing Number, actually produced by the National Theatre, but coming from the Theatre Royal in Plymouth. And that's on Thursday.
I know people who would like to live here.
Me.
Just get a sleeping bag and just stay here all week.
The cinema that I grew up in Birmingham, a cinema called The Electric, it was run by a guy who was known as Smelly Dave, and he literally used to sleep in the back of Screen 2, and Screen 2 always had a slight pong to it.
Hello to Smelly Dave. Paul, thanks very much for letting us come to your lovely cinema.
Thank you.
It's Paul Homer. Okay, so... we're going to get stuck into the box office top 10 very, very shortly. We are expecting Aaron Sorkin to be with us just after 2:35. Unfortunately, no Guillermo del Toro. This is because...
well, he's cancelled. He's not in England.
Yes.
So the problem is he's not here.
And I mean, he's not here because...
well, I think it's something to do with the general sense of Americans that we're not in the most safe place in the world at the moment.
So he's afraid.
He's very afraid. That was the tagline for the fly, wasn't it? Be afraid, be very afraid.
So we apologise that Guillermo's not here. We do have Aaron Sorkin. The most discussed element of the show in the last 7 days is typified by this email from Ruth Gard. Dear Winston Churchill and Penelope Leach, as a stickler... who do you want to be?
Penelope Leach. Okay.
As a stickler both for good grammar and good parenting, I pondered Mark's question as to which would be more irritating to be pulled up on. I came to the conclusion that it's not the subject but the manner in which one is criticised that would be the irritant for me.
Okay.
As Simon's manner of expression is so diplomatic, measured, and so pithily eloquent...
That is Simon Bates we are talking about there, isn't it?
Not to mention so charmingly deadpan, I would be happy to be criticised by him on virtually any grounds. Dr. K should learn a thing or two from Simon about diplomacy and measured... pithy charm.
Yeah, Dr. K should learn a thing or two from Simon about picking the emails he reads out.
I hope you will. It was just handed to me.
Oh, yeah, right.
I hope you will read this out to make up for the bitter disappointment of not being amongst the elect at the East Finchley Phoenix, my local cinema. I heard the podcast too late to get a ticket. I saw many a good film there as part of their baby cinema program because they let babies in. As well as an absolute stinker, namely Love Actually, possibly the worst film I've ever been subjected to.
It's not to which I have ever been subjected. Sorry.
In last week's podcast, says Edmund, not content with haranguing the listeners for their bad grammar, the good doctor turned his fire on Simon. On discussing the clip from the Mark Cousins film, Simon said, in the context of the images which that voiceover goes with, and Mark leapt in with, with which that voiceover goes, podcast 1 hour, 1 minute, 20 seconds. Could this be the same Dr. K who 20 minutes earlier, in his breathless appreciation of Made in Dagenham, said,
almost certainly,
it is a film about a group of people that you believe in. Shouldn't that be, it is a film about a group of people in whom you believe? This is a very difficult path that you've gone down.
It is.
Let's do the box office top 10. At 10, we have Grown Ups,
which I paid to see because I was away when it came out, and I didn't enjoy it. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was lame, and I do not understand the enduring box office appeal of those people. But do we have somebody here who has enjoyed it more than me?
I think we have. What's your name, sir?
My name's Nick. And
where are you from, Nick?
I'm from Woodford.
Yes.
And I saw Grown Ups, and I thought it was another awful addition to the Adam Sandler and Dennis DeGan relationship.
What I don't understand is, why did you go and see it?
Oh, well, I didn't see it for... I didn't pay. I saw it in a cafe in Vietnam.
Thanks. <That's> Enough said. Devil at number 9.
I've got fear of lifts anyway, and I don't like lifts.
And pomegranates,
yes. But the problem with Devil is it is like a 29-minute Twilight Zone episode stretched out over 90 minutes. If within the first 5 minutes you don't guess who the protagonist character is, then, or the central character, then you're just not trying. And it's the beginning of it. It's announced
you're trying to
as
say
being
the devil.
It's announced as being the Night Chronicles, so I assume we're going to have a load of these. And it's a shame because the screenplay for it is written by the guy who wrote Hard Candy, which is a brilliant screenplay, and this is nothing like that.
Jack Godwin in Swindon says, to exoticized, eroticized Buddhist and aerobicized observable erosion. I think I'm the latter and you're the former.
We do also have a devil.
I know, I'm going to get to that. After hearing M. Night Shyamalan mispronounced, I would like to suggest that from now on you make a habit of referring to him as Night Maybe best to think of something delicious when you say this. Maybe a pomegranate, says Jack. Also, did Mark find the contrast of the ending of Buried and the jolly music that followed in the credits as odd as I did?
No, but I thought that it's deliberately sort of oddball and funny. At the end of Buried, I was jelly. I was holding James King's hand.
Who's that there waiting to speak to us on the subject of Devil?
Louis.
Hello, Louis. Where are you from?
From Manchester.
Thanks very much indeed for coming to the show. What did you make of Devil?
I thought it was like fun, but in a very, very thin, like bare bones kind of way, maybe.
There we go. Nothing going on in it. See? Mm. Bunch of people trapped in a lift. That's it.
How long did it take you to spot the devil?
About 20 minutes, if I'm being honest.
20 minutes, all right. Thank you very much for coming down. Toy Story 3 is at number 8.
Well, clearly the best movie trilogy of all time, outranking things like Godfather, certainly Star Wars, which people keep saying, what about the Star Wars trilogy? Yeah, go, yeah, but the third one, Star Wars, is, as Kevin Smith says in Clerks, it is Muppets in space. And the best thing about Toy Story 3 is you need to see it in 2D, because I virtually got the director of the film to admit that it's better in 2D. Because I said, which version would you want people to see it in? And he said, I'd want them to see the 2D. And then he paused and he said, and then the 3D. But he started with the 2D. And there's a reason for that. It's because the 2D version's better.
Yes. So what's your name?
Alex.
Where are you from, Alex?
I'm from just down the road. So this is my local cinema.
Okay. It's very nice to have you here. Thanks for making the effort. 3D or 2D?
I saw it in 3D and loved it. I haven't seen it in 2D. I'll need to see it and make a judgment.
Did you feel that the experience was enhanced by the 3D-ness of it?
I enjoyed it. I thought it added
something.
Your
opinion is perfectly valid, even if it's different to Mark's.
So, like I say, I didn't see the 2D version, but I saw the 3D and loved it, so I'd have to see the 2D and then come back to you on that. But
okay, it is worth seeing the 2D version because it is better. And you saw it in 3D. You didn't think the 3D added anything. You
absolutely
thought the 3D was pointless.
Absolutely nothing at all, no. And certainly more sense than the 3D, as we mentioned before, in The Hole, where it does make sense and not in Toy Story. Thank you very much. Back to the Future at number 7.
Well, the funny thing about Back to the Future is it genuinely is a diehard classic. And it's interesting watching it again after all these years, although I've seen it a lot in the interim because we've got a DVD of it. Just how good it is and just how much it holds up. I mean, recently when Hot Tub Time Machine came out and Crispin Glover was in it, and it was like you kept thinking, why aren't I watching Back to the Future? And then you watch Back to the Future and go, that is a really, really smart movie. The bit at the end when he goes, blues in B, watch me for the changes and try and keep up, is one of the great musical gags of modern cinema. It's wonderful. It's a really wonderful film. Back to the Future 2 is a bit of a duffer. Back to the Future Part 3 is a partial return to form, I think.
And it's made in Dagenham at number 6.
Which I really love. I'd like to see it higher up in the chart. I think it's great. It's got a movie which has got something to say, but doesn't bore you or lecture you in saying it's about a very important story, but it's very, very entertaining. It's, There, as you know, there was a debate last week with Steve Woolley, who was complaining that it's been given a 15 certificate because it has 16 or 17 uses of the F word. I understand entirely why the BBFC gave it a 15. Steve thought it was important that it was seen by audiences of all ages because it's a very important story. The most important thing to say about it is just how much fun it is, just how enjoyable it is, just how entertaining it is, how well played it is, how well written it is. It's really a good balance between solid substance and just sheer entertainment.
There's a lady standing next to the microphone. Are you for Made in Dagenham, madam?
Yes.
Okay, what's your name?
My name's Ramula.
Ramula, and where are you from?
Locally.
Okay, you're local to East Finchley, indeed.
To Muswell Hill and East Finchley, and this is my local cinema.
And what did you make of Made in Dagenham?
I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was an interesting take on the notion of granting women equal pay. And it was light, and people could enjoy. But it was actually a real event that happened in history. So I thought it was an important film, and I loved the way that they put it across. It was funny.
And in the cinema that you saw it in, were people enjoying it? Were people laughing? Oh, you
saw it
in front. And was it playing well? Were people laughing and enjoying
yes,
it?
Yes.
See, it is a crowd-pleasing hit, even though the subject doesn't sound like it ought to be.
Ramona, thanks very much indeed. Some emails on this. Sarah, but if you've seen Made in Dagenham, put your hand up. We'll come to you. And
no, we've just done Made in Dagenham.
I know. We're still on Made in Dagenham.
Oh, I beg your
emails
pardon.
On Made in Dagenham.
Sorry.
Sarah, I'll point at you when I want you to speak.
Okay.
Sarah in Bournemouth, I just watched Made in Dagenham with my friend Flora. Speaking as a 16-year-old girl, I think it was inspiring, energizing, and empowering. Finally, a film worth £7.50. I intend on buying the DVD, and when it's out, telling anyone who'll listen to watch it too, including younger cousins and future children. Cope, we're women. Now don't ask such stupid questions. Nick from Durham. If Stephen Woolley, who was on the show last week, cared so much that the message of his film was communicated to young girls, then he'd have cut the swearing. Why is the F word so important to the message and authenticity? Then he says, truth is something very different to facts and realism, and his victimized stance on the show was just infuriating. Give me a break. The fact that he is so bewildered about the 15 rating shows just how disconnected and inconsiderate he is. Get a grip. Your precious artistic pretensions have ruined the chances of your film reaching the audience you claim will get the most from it.
Well, I'd like to say, in his defense, I don't think it is an example of that. I think it's an example of the fact that he's a filmmaker. He thinks first about the film and then afterwards about the classification. I think what he did was, I mean, he's the producer. He's not the director. He's one of two producers. I think that they just made the film the way they wanted to make it and then afterwards thought about the issue of classification. I do, however, sympathize with the BBFC. I don't think the BBFC could have passed it at 12 because they would have got complaints because language is the thing that is most complained about by parents.
The Hole in 3D is at number 5.
Which I think is really... I mean, I like Joe Dante very much. He's a proper filmmaker. He's somebody who understands the history of cinema. He's a real film fan. He's made wonderful movies like Gremlins and Matinee, which I think is his best work. I like The Hole. The question of whether The Hole is too scary for 12-year-olds is very interesting. I have to say, I didn't take my kids to see it on the grounds that... I mean, I was going to, and then I thought, you know what, actually, I showed them the trailer with the creepy clown. It is scary. It is really genuinely a scary film, which is, you know, great. It's what I want it to be. I don't personally think it's scary because of the 3D. And I know you keep saying that The Hole justifies 3D.
So it's a better use of 3D than Toy Story.
Yeah, it is a better use. And I have yet to see Werner Herzog's Caving movie, which we are assured is the film that will demonstrate, you know, what you can do with 3D, which is go in a cave. But... But I really like The Hole, but I think there is a problem, which is, would you take a 12-year-old? And, well, it's only if you want to have sleepless nights for the next 5 years. Because it's creepy, isn't it? It's genuinely creepy.
Until they go down the hole. When it's all about the imagination... Here's an email from Janet in Dorchester about... Oh, it's a long email, but she says that prompted by the film, The Journey Home, this is discussing it with the children, was enlivened by a discussion about facing your fears. My son noting that it was very convenient that all characters only had one fear. It wasn't a big step from there to a lively discussion about how other fears would have been portrayed. We felt the pomegranate issue would have presented some significant challenges.
I'm really starting to wish I'd never brought that up.
Mark in Earlsfield in London. I found the comments of the father who took his kids to The Hole 3D only for them to be traumatized surprising. He should have known what he was in for in the knowledge that Joe Dante had made in the past Gremlins, Piranha, and the very underrated Twilight Zone. Admittedly, the critic who likened the scares in the film to monsters in the attic was an idiot. But my kids...
That wasn't me, incidentally.
My kids, who are 10 and 12, loved it. They were terrified, visibly shaking at the scenes with the clown, along with their father, as I hate clowns. But at the end, they both said they loved it because they enjoyed being scared. Fear is a great emotion for a child, within reasons, and I recommend this beautifully lit and nicely paced movie for movie-mature children.
I agree. I think fear is a great emotion. When I was a kid, I loved seeing horror movies, but I also understand that phrase about movie-mature children is right. I mean, not... You know, you just have to judge it. You have to judge it for your own kids, which is why the 12A certificate actually is completely appropriate. The BBFC, very good call. They're completely right. Some kids are fine with it. Some kids really like it. I think there are some people who would be genuinely creeped out by it. I'm 47. It, you know, put the wind up me.
But so does a pomegranate.
So, yeah, you know, so there we go.
Really nice. We are on 5 Live, and we are live from the Phoenix Cinema in East Finchley. Dan in Brighton says, hello, Phoenix Cinema. I can't get the live stream, so I'm watching Simon's empty chair in the studio on the webcam. I've just walked into the room as the audience said, hello, Paul. I now realise you have a guest called Paul, but still feel you were talking to me. From Paul. Dan in Chester, the Phoenix looks amazing watching it on the live stream. It makes me really mad that my city has no cinema in the city centre. And Tommy from Bristol, I'm enjoying the show. I'm watching on the webcam but listening on the radio. You're out of sync and look like a badly dubbed Chinese film. Let's finish off the top four very quickly, then introduce you to our special guest. Eat, Pray, Love is at number 4. Mark?
Eat, Pray, Love, Vomit.
We have it's very good, very pithy. Yes, madam, what's your name?
Hi, my name is Idit.
And where are you from?
East Finchley.
Thank you very much.
They're
for
all from East Finchley.
Okay. Eat, Pray, Love, what did you think?
Yes, we went to see it as fun film for Friday night with the girls. The name Julia Roberts was the attraction. We thought it would be good, but it was very boring, not much substance. And the story, more of a holiday scenes, holiday pictures or adverts, and overall.
Ladies and gentlemen, the station's new film reviewer.
Thank you very much. Buried at number 3.
Well, it really, really creeped me out, being claustrophobic as I am. And I spent the whole film thinking, this is really well done. I'm really impressed. I really like it. I really want it to end.
Yes, sir, who are you?
Hello, my name is Jonah.
What did you make of this film?
I thought it was totally average. I think Ryan Reynolds was the only good thing in it. I think the kidnapper sounded like someone from Phone Jacker. Just terrible.
Thank you.
I'm not getting involved.
The Town at number 2.
Well, it's fine, but it's no more than fine, and I don't understand why it's getting all these extraordinary plaudits. I mean, it's harking back to a time when those kind of films would have been The French Connection, and it ain't The French Connection. It's okay, you know, it's a plot that we have seen before. It's nothing other than fine.
Yes, sir, who are you?
My name is Johnny.
Where are you from, Johnny?
Lanzarote in the Canary Islands.
Well, thanks very much for making the journey over. What did you make of The Town?
Quick hi to my brother Cecil, big fan, and... Sorry.
And everyone else who
yes.
knows you?
Yep.
Everyone
else,
town?
Yes. generic and formulaic, but fun.
Excellent, thank you. And the UK's number 1 is The Other Guys. Okay, that's enough. Yes, sir, who are you?
I'm Josh.
And what did you make of The Other Guys?
I didn't think it was hilarious, but it definitely wasn't unfunny. It had Will Ferrell's wife in it, I thought was really, really bad. I found her excruciating, but Will Ferrell was really funny.
Will Ferrell's rubbish. Mark Wahlberg's funny.
Yeah. Well, Mark Wahlberg, he's playing the straight man, and I didn't think he could do comedy. I loved him in Boogie Nights, but he was good in this.
Thank you very much indeed, and thank you to all our reviewers. It's 20 to 3. This is 5 Live from the Phoenix Cinema. And would you welcome, please, our special guest, Aaron Sorkin, to the stage. Aaron Sorkin. Getting his headphones
thank
on.
You very much.
Aaron, how are you, sir?
I'm good, thank you, but I'm terrified to come back next week and hear the reviews when The Social Network opens.
Why?
These were frightening.
But the guys coming up doing the reviews.
Yes.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks very much indeed.
It's great to be here.
Just set it up for those who have missed all the ads, don't know anything about The Social Network. Just take it from the top, Aaron. Just explain the show.
Sure, as briefly as I can. Facebook was invented by a 19-year-old Harvard sophomore named Mark Zuckerberg. And it took off immediately, as you probably know. Just a few years later, it now has 500 million members and is worth $25 billion. None of that has anything to do with the movie. What the movie is about are the two lawsuits that were brought against Facebook, one by three other Harvard students claiming that Mark Zuckerberg stole the idea from them, the other brought by Mark Zuckerberg's best and perhaps only friend, claiming, if you'll forgive me, that he was screwed out of the company. And the structure of the movie is that we're in two deposition rooms, and we, through these depositions, we see the very strange beginnings of Facebook, and the, we sort of construct the odd puzzle that is Mark Zuckerberg.
Is it extremely difficult to begin to write a screenplay where the facts are disputed? In fact, that's the sort of the core of the film, the fact that you have alternate versions of the truth.
That's right, and it was extremely difficult at the beginning until it became the gift that I was able to work with. Because what happened was, obviously a great deal of research went into this, available research, then cartons and cartons of legal documents, and finally, most importantly, the first-person research, speaking directly to the people, many of whom are characters in the movie. And what emerged was that the defendant, the plaintiffs, the witnesses, they all went into the deposition rooms. They all swore an oath to tell the truth. And we came out with three very different versions of the story. So what I ended up deciding to do, instead of choosing one version and deciding that's the truth, I'll write that, or choosing another version and deciding that's the sexiest, I'll write that, with apologies to Kurosawa, I decided to do Rashomon. And I love courtroom dramas, and that I would not take a position on the truth. I would present everybody's truth as offered in these depositions. As I said, the movie doesn't take a position on what the truth is. It doesn't take a position on who's good, who's bad, who's right, or who's wrong. We encourage those arguments to happen in the parking lot afterward.
But the interesting thing about the film is that even though it doesn't have one version of the truth, the one thing that rings all the way through it is this central irony that it's about somebody who is lacking in the social skills department who invents the ultimate social networking skill.
Mark Zuckerberg is a terribly complicated guy. First of all, he has an IQ of 8,000 or something, and he's not just a genius as a programmer. He's a very talented guy, but he is shy, he is socially awkward, he has his nose pressed up against the window of social life at college, and he is part of a very angry subset of tech geniuses. You know, in the 80s, Hollywood made movies about very cuddly nerds that were easy to love, and we immediately would root for them to, you know, go get those big dumb jocks. This is not that movie. He is very angry that the prettiest girl in school still wants to date the star athlete and not him, because I don't mean this literally. I mean not him. That people just don't understand that he is the one running the universe. So you're absolutely right that the world's most important social networking device, maybe since the telephone, was invented by the world's most antisocial guy. But that's not just a coincidence. There's a reason for that. Mark Zuckerberg invented something he needed. And what he invented was a brand new way to socialize. You can socialize from the solitude of your room. You can reinvent yourself. You can offer the part of yourself that you want the world to see without them seeing your flaws. I can identify with this. I would like everyone to think that I'm as quick and clever and witty as the characters that I write. I would be very happy being in a room by myself, writing a scene, slipping it under the door, and just have somebody slip a meal back for me and have everyone think that I'm Rob Lowe on the West Wing. So I understand where Mark was coming from on this. And he invented this device. At first, it was supposed to be just something that Harvard students would use. Then he branched out to a couple of more schools. And then with the help of Sean Parker, who's played by Justin Timberlake in the movie, Sean Parker is a name that may sound familiar. When he was very young, too, just out of high school, He invented Napster, which was a way for people to share music for free, essentially to rob the music industry of money. Sean Parker then discovered that there wasn't any money to be had in free music, but spotted Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg early on, and he's what took Facebook to the big time.
It's almost as though, Aaron, that Mark Zuckerberg is the only person who could have invented Facebook. I mean, just hearing the way you're describing him with his social inadequacies and his extraordinary IQ, it was only going to be him, wasn't it?
I think so. It's possible that there's one other person out there just like him, but it was a perfect storm of somebody who had the intellectual capacity and the creative capacity to do it, and somebody who was desperately driven to do it, who had to do it.
There is a key line in the film in which, when he's arguing his case against people that are saying that he nicked their idea, he says to them, you know this because you wrote it, if you'd invented Facebook, you would have invented Facebook.
If you were the inventors of Facebook, you'd have invented Facebook. He's being accused of what happens is, and some of these things you honestly can't make up, and I didn't. The movie is nonfiction, but he was approached by a pair of identical twins named Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss, who, if you can imagine, John F. Kennedy Jr., if he were 6'5", 220 pounds, and there were two of them. That's who these two are. They rowed crew for Harvard, ended up rowing crew for the U.S. Olympic team in Beijing. They'll be rowing in London here in 2012. Terribly handsome, wealthy, entitled, brilliant people.
And you hate them from the beginning.
Yeah. Absolute born winners and the opposite of Mark. And they come to Mark because they have an idea for something called Harvard Connection, based on the notion that girls want to date guys who go to Harvard. And this was going to be the difference between Harvard Connection and MySpace or Friendster, was that it was going to be exclusivity, that you needed a harvard.edu address to get on. So everybody was going to go, ooh, this was going to be cool. Mark then took that idea, and the movie doesn't take a position on this. I'm just going to tell you facts that are not in dispute. Kept sandbagging them for 42 days. He said, yes, I'll do it. I'll write the code for your website. And then we have all sorts of email messages between the Winklevosses, or the Winklevi, as Mark referred to them, and Mark saying, I've got to cancel tomorrow's meeting. I've got this test to study for. Sorry, can't get together Thursday. My parents are coming into town. Let's do it Friday. Can't do it Friday. I've got this thing to do. All the while, Mark was building Facebook because he had a different, better, bigger idea, he wanted to get there first. The Winklevosses would sue him for hundreds of millions of dollars. Simultaneously, like I said, Mark's best and maybe only friend, Eduardo Saverin, who is played by a terrific young English actor named Andrew Garfield, was Mark's first partner on Facebook, invested $1,000 in the company for the servers and all the other stuff that they needed, would put in another $18,000 into the company. But when Mark saw this bright, shiny new penny in Sean Parker and Justin Timberlake's character, dumped Eduardo. Eduardo also would sue him for hundreds of millions of dollars. Both of these, well, I won't give away the end of the movie and tell you
but
how
the main
it ends.
Thing is, none of them are suing you for millions of dollars.
None of them are suing me. I'm not worried about them suing me. I'm worried about a building full of people who all know how to hack into my hard drive and put child porn on there. Okay. To get
so
revenge.
We'll be back to do some more with Aaron Sorkin in just a moment. Coming to you from the Phoenix Cinema in East Finchley, Aaron Sorkin is our guest. The Social Network is his new movie. Lots of texts and lots of emails coming in. No one has hacked into your computer, as far as we know, Aaron. These are all genuine questions. Did you approach this? Well, I mean, what were your views on the internet and Facebook and Twitter and all that? Were you involved? Were you engaged? Or is it another country for you?
It's another country for me. When I signed up for this, I didn't know much about Facebook at all. I'd heard of it, but I'd heard of it the way I've heard of a carburetor. I can't pop the hood of my car and point to it and tell you what it is. And it wasn't a Facebook that interested me, and I want to underline that point that you don't have to be on Facebook or love Facebook. You can not have heard of Facebook, and you have as much of a chance of enjoying the movie as the person sitting next to you who checks their status update 10 times a day. That Facebook is simply the modern backdrop against which a very classical story is being told, a story of friendship and loyalty and betrayal and jealousy and power and class, the kind of thing that Aeschylus would have written about, or Shakespeare would have written about, or Paddy Chayefsky would have written about. And it was just lucky for me that none of those guys were available, so I got to write about it.
If anyone has any questions for Aaron Sorkin, if you put your hand up, we'll get a microphone to you as soon as possible. Are these the youngest people you've written about?
They are. I hadn't written about characters this young, and the first day of writing, there were many, many months of research, followed by many, many months of climbing the walls and pacing around, not knowing what to do and staring at a blank screen with the cursor flashing at you. But when I did know what the first scene was going to be, I suddenly felt their age. The characters jump back and forth between being 19 and 24. Let me pause there and also mention that the movie, which opened in the U.S. last week, has cut across all generational lines, all gender lines. We were 50-50 in over 35 and under 35, male, female, every possible demographic. So you don't have to be 19 or 24 to enjoy the movie either. But on that first day when I was writing, I thought I'm going to have these characters speak like they're 19 years old somehow. I'll need some sort of conversion dictionary or watch commercials for Mountain Dew. I don't know what to do here. And for about 2 hours, I tried to do just that. It was a disaster. It was a catastrophe. It turns out that not all 19-year-olds speak the same, that there's no such thing as 19-year-old language. So I wrote it in my own voice, and we sell that they're 19 because it's young actors playing the parts. And I don't know why I didn't think of that sooner.
We have a couple of questions from the audience. Madam, your name, please.
My name's Corinne Sweet. I'm actually a writer and a huge admirer of yours.
Thanks, Corinne.
I wonder what happened to Studio 60, because it was a completely brilliant series, and it just ended when it was getting very interesting.
So,
and was it about the fact that it was so critical of the industry?
I don't think so. First of all, thank you very much. With a show like Studio 60, it's a difficult show to do. It's a tough needle to thread. My theory on why it ended is that I simply made too many writing mistakes. There are kinds of shows that you can write which are more forgiving in terms of mistakes, procedurals. For instance, cop shows, hospital dramas. Any show that begins where there's a dead body and by the end we find out who did it, you have a little more elbow room to make writing mistakes there. Here you couldn't, and I did, and so the show only lasted one season, 22 episodes, but I'm very proud of those 22 episodes, and I had a great time working on it.
I should say there's a whole vast stack of emails from people all making exactly the same point as Corinne, just wanting that explanation.
I really appreciate that from everyone writing.
Gentleman in the glasses in the middle there.
Yeah, hi, my name's Taz. I'm a trustee of this cinema, which I think you've made a couple of oblique references to so far.
A couple.
As somebody who's been responsible for bringing in this sort of golden age of television, I just wanted to ask you what you think about that effect in terms of what it's done for cinema, because it strikes me as that there's been an extraordinary rebirth of television, great high-quality writing, production values, and I wonder whether you think that's upped the game for cinema.
Yeah.
Secondary question.
Yes.
Because we're here in this fabulous cinema.
The trouble is, Aaron, do you have to go at three, Aaron? Is that true?
It is true.
Okay, so okay. Can I...
Okay, we'll just answer.
Just
okay. Yeah, I think game on. It used to be, at least in the U.S., the BBC is much better at this. But it used to be in the U.S. that television was the ugly stepchild of features, and that it was the minor leagues. That's been over for about a decade now. Some of the best theater in America now is on television, whether it's HBO or even some of the networks. And as a result, you'll find some of the best screenwriters now migrating to television. because it doesn't take you 2 years to get something done. While the schedule in television may be ferocious, there is something nice about with a film. If I were to write a joke today and everything went perfectly smoothly, I wouldn't hear the laugh for 2 years. With television, there's going to be something on television in 6 weeks that I haven't thought of yet, and that immediacy is terrific. So it's attracting a lot of terrific writers, and now it's everybody's in the NFL.
Quick question from the gentleman in the turquoise shirt.
Oh, hi, it's Timothy here. I'm from Dalston.
Yes,
Tim. Do you know if Mark Zuckerberg will see the film? What do you think he would think of the portrayal of him if he were to see it?
In fact, he did. Last Friday, on October 1st, the day the movie opened, Mark surprised everyone, his staff and the media, by buying out a movie theater and taking the entire Facebook staff, some 500 people, to the theater to see it. As it happens, Jesse Eisenberg, who plays Mark Zuckerberg in the movie, Jesse's first cousin is a senior staffer at Facebook, works closely with Mark Zuckerberg. So Jesse's cousin sent a quick text to Jesse saying, Mark really loved all the parts he agreed with.
So, Aaron, we have 2 minutes before you go. He's the film critic. So
yes.
On the social network, it would be sensible for you to say what you think.
Before you say anything, film critic, I want to tell you that I think you're a very handsome and powerful man.
Never been said before.
Just very quickly, I was saying that my favorite line in the movie is there's a bit when Mark Zuckerberg is sitting down and somebody comes up to him and says, there's a girl that you know, I want to know if she's going out with somebody. And he says, and this is the chubby hum moment, he says, well, hang about, people don't walk around with notice boards saying, hang on a minute.
Yes, he's in the middle of designing Facebook, or back then they called it the Facebook, before Sean Parker made his biggest contribution to the company, which was saying cut the. But he's not sleeping. He's spending weeks on end writing the code for Facebook. These coding sequences, by the way, I should tell you, David Fincher, our director, badly wanted to be here. He's in Sweden right now directing The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. But David Fincher, who is mostly known as being peerless as a visual director, is now yoked to me. I am, if I'm known at all, known for being writing people talking in rooms. And so David managed to make scenes of coding look like action sequences and hacking. You're on the edge of your seat. But he's in, as you said, Mark is in the middle of building this thing, and he's tired, and he's in his computer lab, and a friend comes up and says, hey, there's this girl in such and such a class named Stephanie Addis. Do you happen to know if she's seeing anybody? And if she's not, do you happen to know if she's be interested in seeing anybody? And Mark is very frustrated. He says, yeah, for God's sake, people don't walk around with signs on them that say, and then bolts to his dorm and puts the final touch on Facebook for relationship status.
We have 30 seconds left before the news. What are you working on next, Aaron? Lots of people want to know your next project.
I appreciate that. There'll be a new television series. I'm not allowed to tell you, but
East Wing.
That's right. I promise you that right 10 minutes before we make the announcement, I will call and tell you about
it. It's called Live from the Phoenix in East Finchley. It's a big hit.
New television series, a new movie, a new Broadway show.
Aaron,
thank you all very
great
very
to
much.
Be on the show. Aaron Sorkin. Reviews in this hour for
Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, Restrepo, and Mr. Nice, which is the new Reese Ifans film.
Jeff Hickman says, after listening to last week's program, I must write to you to put an end to the debate, he puts in capital letters, about the ending of Inception. It's kind of a spoiler alert, but not really.
Yeah, you've got to be very careful with this, because I have been told off now whilst reviewing Buried for spoiling the end of The Vanishing.
Okay, fine. When did that come out?
Well, that's exactly it. The Vanishing is like mid-80s. There must be a moratorium on giving away the ending of a film, wasn't there? What, in 20 years it's acceptable, yeah?
Well, I think this is okay. Yeah, I'm sure it is. Jeff Hickman says, let me clarify things for you both. You were discussing whether or not the final scene is a dream. We don't know if it's a dream. This is the point of the final shot. We don't know. We cannot know. No matter how much you debate it, it will not be able to change this truth. It doesn't matter what anyone tells you, even if, like Michael Caine, they are in the film, even if the writer...
If I bid the film, then it's not a dream.
Even if the writer or the director tells you different, the film itself cannot be argued with. The audience does not know. That is what makes it the most perfect ending, says Jeff.
Is he right?
Well...
says Michael Caine.
What, is it a dream then? There you go. You see, they kept the secret. They kept the secret. Darlene, listening in Auckland, New Zealand. On Saturday mornings, here on the other side of the world, New Zealand to be precise, an ever-expanding community eagerly anticipates downloading your latest weekly wittering. To add to your collection of recorded health benefits, I can attest to the fact that I am no longer frustrated by traffic, and I have even found myself welcoming red lights and longer car journeys now that I am accompanied by your sparkling wit and silly banter.
Don't look at me.
I have been delighted to have hooked on an aspiring filmmaker son of our dear friends into this mad, mad world, and we now have regular conversations around the podcast. Have you heard? Have you seen? Did you agree with the good doctor? And so on. The family around us just roll their eyes. They haven't got a clue what we're talking about. Well, this guy, Zach, was married yesterday, and in his wedding speech, as he was rounding up with his thank yous, I caught his eye and mouthed, "And hello." And yes, to a very confused Kiwi gathering of his nearest and dearest, he said in his wedding speech,
hello to Jason Isaacs.
I would love if you could possibly say hello to Zach Jacobson on your podcast, which he will download on return to his honeymoon.
Should we get the whole of the Phoenix to say hello to him en masse?
Okay, so on behalf of everyone here at the Phoenix, it's Zach Jacobson you're saying hello to. After three, two, three.
Hello, Zach Jacobson.
And the new Mrs. Jacobson, always assuming that's all still together.
Which one imagines
that it certainly is. Mayo at bbc.co.uk for the emails. What would be the big movie of the week in terms of posters and taking a lot of attention?
Wall Street Money Never Sleeps, which of course premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, which I first saw then, which I've seen again now. So the story is, everybody who remembers Wall Street, there was an interesting period when Michael Douglas was the zeitgeist guy. If you were making any movie with a zeitgeisty feel, you would get Michael Douglas. So if you were making Disclosure about whether a woman can sexually harass a man, you get Michael Douglas. If you were making Fatal Attraction about whether or not, you know, an extramarital affair is always going to end incompletely, you go and get Michael Douglas. And in the case of Wall Street, you know, if you're going to make a movie about finance and is money bad and is greed good, then you go and get Michael Douglas. So Oliver Stone revisits the main characters of Wall Street, centrally Gordon Gekko, after a long period of absence, in which we discover that Gekko has been in prison. The film begins with a good gag, is that Gordon Gekko comes out of prison and he goes to get his stuff back. And many of you may have read this. He goes to get his stuff back and they give him back his belongings, which include a mobile phone the size of a small hamster cage. And then he goes outside, because he was Gordon Gekko, he's very famous, where he goes out and a limousine pulls up. He imagines that the limousine is for him. It's not. It's for the black guy standing next to him, who's some kind of rap star, and Gordon Gekko is completely left on his own. So the idea of this at the beginning is the world has changed. Everything has changed since he was put in prison. Now, Gordon Gekko himself has changed, and his central message before, greed is good, has changed to the rather more ambivalent, is greed good? Here's a clip from Wall Street Money Never Sleeps.
Someone reminded me the other evening that I once said, greed is good. Now it seems it's legal. Is greed that makes your parents refinance their $200,000 house for $250,000. And then they take that extra $50,000, they go down to the mall. They buy a plasma TV, cell phones, computers, an SUV. And hey, why not a second home while we're at it? Because gee whiz. I mean, we all know the prices of houses in America always go up, right? And it's greed that makes the government in this country cut the interest rates to 1% after 9/11. So we could all go shopping again. They got all these fancy names for trillions of dollars of credit. CMOs, CDOs, SIVs, ABSs. You know, I honestly think there's maybe only 75 people in the world who know what they are. But I'll tell you what they are. The WMDs. Weapons of mass destruction.
Now, the interesting thing about the film is that pretty much every moment that Michael Douglas is on screen it's interesting because he is a great screen presence. I mean, it's an interesting thing. He's got that. I mean, people have compared him in the past to Fred McMurray. He does that thing about the damaged, somehow victimized man quite well. But he also does the thing about the charismatic, slightly mad guy. I mean, he is a commanding screen presence. At the center of the original Wall Street, there was this strange paternal triangle, which had Charlie Sheen and Martin Sheen. And Martin Sheen was a character who basically represented people who did things, who made things, who built things. And Charlie Sheen was the guy who originally wanted to be his father and idolized his father, but then during the course of the movie actually decides that he wants to be Gecko. And Gecko is the character who embodies that idea that people don't make things, people make money. And there's a key scene in the first film in which Charlie Sheen says to Martin Sheen's character, he says, you know, when I look at you, I see somebody who's, you know, scared and afraid. And what Martin Sheen says is, no, when you look at me, you see somebody who never judged another person by the size of his wallet. And this is the sort of central thesis of Wall Street. Now, in Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, they're attempting, well, Oliver Stone is attempting once again to do that kind of strange, tortured family thing. But this time you have Shia LaBeouf, the charisma vacuum that is Shia LaBeouf, who is dating Carey Mulligan, who is the offspring of Gordon Gekko, from whom she is estranged because she is now involved in some sort of slightly revolutionary, radical journalism eco thing, which he is as well. He's involved in investment in forming different kinds of power. And he, in the meantime, is trying to sort things out with his mother, who's running a housing business, a real estate business. And the whole thing is much more, on the one hand, complicated and flimsy, and on the other hand, just not as engaging. See, the thing with the first film is I really believed in the father-son relationship, and I really believed in the central thing, which was that the son is somehow led astray by this dazzling dream of you can make money out of nothing, you can conjure it out of thin air. In the second film, it's much more fudgy, it's much more woolly, it's much more confused. Now, you could argue to some extent that what's happened is that Stone has changed his target because the world has changed, because actually it's no longer as simple to look at the financial markets and go, okay, this is what I think about it. Actually, I don't think that's the problem at all. I think the key problem is that what's happened is that when Stone started out making movies, he was an incredibly belligerent filmmaker. And I mean, I've said this before, watching an Oliver Stone movie was like being yelled at. And so, if you saw Platoon was, war is hell! And if you saw, Any Given Sunday, it was, sport is being corrupted by money! And if you saw Wall Street, it was, greed is bad, money is corrupting it. If you watch it now, it's like, well, it's a bit difficult, and there's this, and there's that. Now, you do have the character of Josh Brolin, who is doing the sort of, the proper, full-on bad guy. So there is something approaching the sort of nemesis figure. But then you have Gordon Gekko, with whom Stone appears to be equally entranced and disgusted in a way that doesn't work like it did in the first film. You can't quite figure out what his taking is. And I think here's what's happened to Stone. Stone has actually become somebody who's become much more aware of the complexities of life. If you look at his documentaries, if you look at South of the Border, it's a film in which he listens to people, in which he goes and speaks to these leaders, in which he listens to them. Actually, he has matured, and in maturing he has mellowed, and during the course of that mellowing his documentary filmmaking has improved hugely, because he now makes documentaries in which he literally goes and gives other people a chance to speak. The interesting thing about it is that what he's gained in the documentary department, he's kind of lost in the dramatic department, because whatever else you thought about it, there was something about an Oliver Stone movie which was like being run down by a truck. I mean, when Wall Street was first put out, it was described as the guy who made Platoon takes the war to Wall Street, and Wall Street played like a war movie in the same way as that novel Bombardiers. I mean, it was basically something that was happening in the financial markets, but played out like a war. This plays out much more like somebody who's interested in the Gecko character, wants to get the Gecko character back on screen, isn't entirely sure what to say about the financial market anymore, has completely lost sight of what he's attempting to do with the family relationship, suffers because of the fact that he's attempting to get you to invest all this interest in the Shia LaBeouf character, which I simply don't, because I don't believe in the Shia LaBeouf character. And every moment that Michael Douglas isn't on screen, the whole thing goes... And there are long sections of it in which he's not on screen. It's not terrible, and there are flashes of what made Wall Street the film it was. But as somebody who's actually admired the fact that Oliver Stone seems to have grown up and stopped yelling, I could have done with a bit more shouting and a bit less, on the one hand this and on the other hand that. And Shia LaBeouf, what is that about? What is the whole Shia LaBeouf thing about?
Nick in Newcastle on Tyne, dear Hobbs and Locke. Do you want to be Thomas Hobbs or John Locke?
John Locke.
We took my four-month-old son to see Wall Street. Baby's led in again.
Great, it's good.
great. It's good.
At the excellent Tyneside Cinema, bringing in baby screening on Wednesday. At the end of the movie, I asked him what he thought of it. He replied, "Why, oh why, did Oliver Stone have to do that?" "What, son?" said I. "Well," he rejoined, "he skillfully made a perfectly watchable satire on the collapse of banking and then ruined it by turning the dystopia into a utopia in a nanosecond at the end. I mean, what kind of baby was the saccharine ending aimed at? I'm only 4 months old and I could have coped with a more edgy conclusion."
I think the... I agree with his 4 month old assessment. That's very good. But the problem is that by the time he gets to the end, he's so lost sight of what it is he's trying to say that anything, I mean, it is true the ending is bad, but anything would have felt like that. I mean, that's the problem. The problem is that the thing simply doesn't have a through line. It looks like it's musing and wandering and meandering, and it's kind of, and it's very ill disciplined. I mean, it's really, really ill disciplined. That's actually centrally the problem. And, you know, Oliver Stone movies were always overlong, but they had a forward narrative, which was Oliver just charging forward at you.
Neil Crone, who's in Edinburgh. "Dear Fear and Desperation, long-time listener, and first time email, I love the show. Steve, last night I went with my girlfriend and another couple to see Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps." Not Wall Street 2, is it?
No, it's not. It's definitely Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, part duh.
"I suggest that if people value their time or money, they should avoid this film. Utterly appalling from start to finish. So cringing was the dialogue that people in the packed screen were laughing. An awkward cameo from a well-known TV star halfway in was enough to make me wish I could have walked out. Oliver Stone has let everyone down. There are a lot of discussions using acronyms that would only be known to people who work in finance, but of course in the next sentence, the script then directs the actor to briefly explain all of these so the audience understands. This is done very clumsily. At one point, Shia LaBeouf's character receives a phone call, and the person he is speaking to appears in a soft circular bubble in the middle of the screen. This seems like a juvenile way to depict this and something I would expect in Hollyoaks. It's that bad. There are a lot of these visual methods in the movie, all are heinous. A fact that could and should have been a slick and a film that should have been a slick and exciting thriller with some poignant comment to make on the fallacy of wealth creation that caused the recent market crash was basically a loose, boring, infantile disgrace."
Yeah, I'd still fly the flag for the moments that Michael Douglas is on screen, because I do think he's an interesting screen presence. I think he really has something. I don't know what it is, but he has something.
There is a lady four rows back who has seen this film. Hello, what is your name?
Sandra.
Hello, Sandra. Where are you from?
Near here.
From just round the corner. Something strange going on there. And you've seen the movie? When did you see it?
When? I saw it a couple of weeks ago.
Okay. What did you make of this new Wall Street film, not Wall Street 2?
Well, I agree really with Mark. I found Michael Douglas on screen was quite gripping, but I thought a lot of the film was incomprehensible and quite tedious, really.
Incomprehensive, incomprehensible and tedious. Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. There's a lady halfway back, I think. Yes, madam, what's your name?
Bex.
Okay, Bex, thanks for coming to the show today. What did you think of the new Wall Street film?
Well, I love the soundtrack.
Okay.
That's almost like saying, you know, the lighting is really good, isn't it?
It was, yeah, the lighting was good too.
Right. So the lighting and the soundtrack. And anything else?
Too long. I was getting very uncomfortable, bored. Right. But otherwise, fine.
Where do you stand on the Shia LaBeouf question?
I agree with you, charisma vacuum.
See, I just don't get it. And apparently he's the most bankable star in Hollywood at the moment. So in terms of the amount of money you invest in him and the amount you get back, he's top of the pile. Don't get it.
So the fact that Oliver Stone has become more nuanced is not a good thing.
Not in this particular film, no. He could have done with being less nuanced. I mean, I know that it's ironic to end up saying that, but the fact of the matter is what this film needs is not somebody being lost and being confused. What it needs is somebody having a direction. That's what he had in the first film. In the end, he probably shouldn't have ever gone back to this, because the fact of the matter is he doesn't seem to feel as passionate about it or as single-mindedly passionate about it as he did before.
Are there any people here who love Shia LaBeouf? Or even, let me just say, feel slightly warmly towards Shia LaBeouf, who would like to shout Shia LaBeouf's corner? Do not be intimidated by this man here. Anyone got anything positive to say about Shia LaBeouf? There's a gentleman at the back in a red T-shirt who has something to contribute.
He did apologise for Indiana Jones.
He did apologise for Transformers 2, actually. He did say in the case of Transformers 2 that they dropped the ball I think that just means, well, that's even worse. That just compounds the guilt. You're in it, and now you're admitting it was rubbish.
What
I wanted you to do was to admit that it was rubbish at the time that I was having to watch the wretched thing. It's all very well saying it a year later, incidentally, on the basis of, oh, but the new one's going to be better. How is the new one going to be better? It's still directed by Michael Bay. I don't understand.
Is that the only thing that you could think of to be positive about Shia LaBeouf?
Well, I mean, at least he's aware of his own failings.
Okay, that's another positive thing. We've got a hand up down here, down on the front. Someone else has something to contribute to the Shia LaBeouf debate, such as it is. Well, it's a bit one-sided, really. Yes, sir?
I first saw him in Disturbia, and I actually quite liked him there.
He was ripped off a Hitchcock film, but there we go.
Yes, but I thought he was good.
And I can't imagine Hitchcock casting him, but carry on.
Don't intimidate. Oh, this is
not intimidating him, I'm just saying.
Well, yes, but that was the only time I actually thought it was good, but he has been good, in my opinion, at least.
In Even Stevens, the children's television programme in which he was first an annoying presence, apparently he was fine.
And that's it. There's it's not. I apologise, not a balanced debate. That was just...
Can I move on to Zac Efron?
Hang on a sec.
Because Zac's great.
Joel Rivlin in Alexandria, Vancouver. Please advise. I just got word, see below, very, very long email here, which I can pass round. They're planning on closing numerous roads for the filming of the next incarnation of Transformers in my adopted home of Washington, D.C. Got the entire filming schedule here and the streets that are going to be closed. Starting with 3rd Street between Constitution Avenue Northwest and Independence Avenue Southwest, 6:30 Tuesday, October the 12th, till 6:30 a.m. Wednesday, October the 13th. Vast reams of this. The filming, says Joel, seems to be taking place primarily between my office, my wife's office, and the hospital in which she is due to give birth sometime in the next 4 weeks. Having never been around a movie set filled with emotionless animatrons, is there some kind of etiquette that should be followed when needing them to stop? Not so much so we can get to the hospital unhindered, but really for the cinematic future of the baby.
No.
Well, I'm sure someone will construct some kind of etiquette. You can imagine how frustrating. You're going to be late getting to the hospital for the arrival of your child, and it's Transformers that they're filming. If anyone wants the entire filming schedule...
We'll put it online.
In that vein, from Martin Reuter, dear Flappy Hands and Mumblecore, with a highly anticipated Pirates of the Caribbean being shot in Greenwich, which is happening at the moment, surely the time has come to round up your followers here and get down there just to simply shout, stop
it!
It's time to act on the advice handed out to your listeners. I await a call to arms. We could, at the end of the show, if I didn't have another show to go and do, march from here to Greenwich to put a stop to the new Pirates film. What say you?
You've got to go off to do All Requests Friday. Your request is they stop. There we go, that's fine.
Would anyone be up for marching to Greenwich? Okay, Mark will lead you. Apart from that, he has to be in Cheltenham.
Yes. Can I very quickly review a film, since that's what I'm here for?
Okay.
No, I was going to do the Charlie Sinclair, but since we've only got a few minutes before the half-past news, there's this film about a town called Panic, which is an animated film, which is a spin-off of a Belgian TV series. And it's described in the press notes as one of a rare handful of movies to be officially selected in Cannes, animated movies to be officially selected in Cannes. It's made with stop-motion. Some of you will be aware of this because you've seen the individual episodes. It's made with these tiny little kids' toys, one of which is a cowboy, one of which is an Indian, one of which is a horse. And they go on sort of various mad adventures. I was attempting to do a plot synopsis of this, okay? I got this far. Cowboy, Indian, and horse live together. Cowboy and Indian want to build the horse a birthday barbecue. They try to order 50 bricks. Unfortunately, they order 5 million bricks. The bricks end up being put on top of their house, which causes the house to collapse and fall down beneath the earth where it goes into the water, where the bricks are being stolen by Martians who are attempting to build their own house beneath the surface of the earth. And at one point, there's a fabulous scene there in which the cowboy, the horse, and the Indian are in a room. One of them answers the phone. Somebody says, I'd like to speak to Horse. And he says, is there anybody here called Horse? To which the horse says, yes. It's that kind of film. Now,
hang on. Then what happens?
Well, then the horse takes the phone call because Horse is called Horse. And here's the thing. The screening that I saw it in, it was...
How does it finish?
Well, I mean, how does it continue? I'm in the first sort of 10 minutes of it.
Okay.
It was a genuinely... I really enjoyed it. It was a genuinely baffling experience. It was a subtitled film. And two things I thought. One was I'm really glad to be watching it in the original dialogue, because the subtitles were attempting to keep up with the dialogue, which is completely crazy. But it reminded me of, and you're going to wince at this, it reminded me of that kind of animated madness of Magic Roundabout. Because it had that same sense of, on the one hand, this will appeal to younger viewers, although
I think the subtitles will put younger viewers off. On the other hand, it will appeal to older viewers who are just... I mean, I was sat there in a room of middle-aged critics, literally going, what? He's underwater now? Who's the Martian? What happened with the horse playing the... The horse can't get to the piano lesson because the house has been rebuilt underwater by fish? How come they're breathing? And it was... And it, whilst all this was going on, there was this incredible sense of every minute... Every single minute, something would happen, a widget would happen in the plot, and this thing would go off in a totally different tangent. And actually, a part of me thought, what would be really interesting is if Eric Thompson was around to revoice the whole thing in a ridge, because of course that's what Eric Thompson famously did with Magic Roundabout. So the reason I mention this is because Magic Roundabout, Doodle and the Blue Cat's coming out for the first time on DVD. Town Called Panic is in cinemas. Both of them are representative of what you can do with really genuinely bonkers animation, and both of them are very, very enjoyable.
That's fantastic, but... A little bit more detail on the plot?
Well, after the Martians steal the... They may not be Martians. They're the thing with fish ears. And they steal the bricks to build a house underwater. And there's a farmer with a tractor who his house ends up falling down and goes into the pond. And then the bricks go through the... But it's weird because when they go through the pond, the law of gravity doesn't seem to apply the same way. But the horse does end up getting to the piano lesson, which is being taught by a very, very sexy mare with whom he wants to have a relationship.
Mayor. M-A-R-E.
Mayor, not a mayor. Not a hear ye, mayor.
Could be. That's a town crier, not it a mayor.
Is. Oh, you know what I mean.
Did you say fish ears?
Fish ears, yeah, big... Well, Martian fish ears. It's like a green cow. You know, you...
Martian fish ears?
Kids' toys, yes.
You Martian
know,
fish?
Nano, you know, we come in peace. That's well, they don't Williams. Come in peace. They come to steal their bricks. Honestly, it's not what? A film that's really best summed up with a plot synopsis.
I think we spotted that.
It's called A Town Called Panic, and it's Belgian, right? The people who gave you Plastic Bertrand and Tintin, that's all you need to know.
And the singing
and
nun.
And Jean-Claude Van Damme and the singing nun.
It's Five Live. We'll do some more film. What's coming next, by the way?
Charlie St. Cloud, The Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, the new movie starring Zac, I Love Him, Efron.
This is from Taz.
From Finchley.
Dear Doctors, number 75 and far too important to be ranked. On Monday, I was watching Channel 5, and on the flagship tech program, a crude 3D versus 2D experiment took place. The outcome was that those who watched the 3D version of the rather dull monsters versus aliens had a higher heart rate that was sustained throughout the film. I think this proves that 3D is bad for anyone with an underlying heart condition, as most people with underlying heart conditions are generally ignorant until the circumstances exposes the problem. It should be classed as a health and safety risk. And... He just says, could you add this to your dossier?
Dossier of reasons that 3D is bad. The convincing reason that 3D is bad is that people are bored with it and they're not going anymore and it's dying, and within 2 years it'll be a thing of the past, and thank heaven for that.
Paul in Cambridge. In 1982, my then fiancé and I lived in Muswell Hill, and I walked to the Phoenix Cinema. Anyone here from Muswell Hill? Bit of a crowd-pleasing
Very
moment.
Good.
Walked to the Phoenix Cinema in a horrific rainstorm to see a matinee of Richard Pryor live. The cinema was only sparsely populated, and we were completely drenched. So, in the darkness, we took off all our clothes except our underwear and placed our clothes out to dry on the other cinema seats around us. See, that's the great thing. If you haven't got anyone in front of you or to either side...
You can undress.
You can. Halfway through the film, the house lights were brought up... And the manager stood at the stage at the front, and naturally we slunk down into our seats. The cinema manager called out, "Is there a Paul and Linda here? Their flatmate has just rung up to say their flat has flooded and you need to go home." Needless to say, he persisted until we stood up. Me in my underpants and my fiancée in her bra and knickers, to acknowledge that we were indeed present. The management kindly gave us free tickets for another show. Yours, Paul in Cambridge.
Very good.
How about that? Is there anyone here? No, they're all fully clothed and the lights are all up. 3:38, what else is new, Mark?
Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud, which is the new Zac Efron movie. So if you've seen the trailer, you know what the setup for this is. So
I haven't seen the trailer.
Okay, so Zac Efron is Charlie St. Cloud. And at the beginning of the thing, he's got everything in front of him. He's about to have a yachting scholarship to go off and be, you know, incredibly successful and go around and see the world. Very, very early on, and I'm not giving anything away because this happens in the trailer, his young brother gets killed in a car crash. The car crash is caused by a drunken driver, but he is driving the car. Therefore, he feels a sense of responsibility. We then move forward 5 years. He is now still exactly where he was before, living, tending the graveyard, the local graveyard, and every night going out to a certain place to make a rendezvous with the
is it a ghost or is it a vision of his brother, to whom he made a promise that he would teach him how to play baseball, and despite the tragic events, he is still going and making that and meeting that promise every night. Here's a clip.
The first leg is an all-out 8,000-mile sprint to Cape Town. Boom shakalaka. I would kill that. You would never catch me.
Slider?
No, I don't feel like retrieving balls today. See, rounding Cape Horn is where it gets tricky. The southern seas are tough for even the most experienced sailors because of
the... They have blood-sucking sea monkeys.
Icebergs.
And of course, the... icebergs. You could never do this race.
Why? Why can't I do the race?
It's a solo race. You couldn't take being alone for 6 months. No way.
I could do it.
Oh, what? What if it wasn't for me, you could go?
No, Sam, I didn't say that. I just said I could. I won't, of course, but I could.
Hey, don't let me stop you.
Oh, getting angry? Trying to bring the heat, Sam?
The heat? That's not heat. You want heat?
Bring the heat, Sammy.
Let's go.
Now, the interesting thing about this is the 12 certificate movie, and in the trailer you pretty much get what it's about. It's about tragedy and loss, and then having the brother is still there in a way that seems to resemble either Ghost or The Sixth Sense, the I See Dead People, which is the comparison which an awful lot of critics have made. Actually, the closer comparison is to that peculiar film Bridge to Terabithia, which the first time I saw it I really didn't get very much, and then I went to see it again, and the second time round I was much more impressed by it. The interesting thing about it is it's directed by Burst Ears, who started out making films like Igby Goes Down, which was a very edgy drama and had a lot more of a caustic edge to it. And this is very mainstream fare, and Zac Efron has a very big, solid fan base, and it's easy to see why, because he is, in my opinion, a proper old-style movie star. I mean, people find it incredibly easy to mock and sneer, and, we were talking about the High School Musical movies and how, generally grown-up critics think that they're fluffy and ridiculous. But the fact of the matter is, he comes from a tradition of acting in which singing, dancing, physical movement, proper performance was something that was highly regarded, something which, as I think many people would agree, fell by the way after Marlon Brando demonstrated that what acting is really about is going and eating a lot of cakes. And
you looked like him then.
I did. More the cake thing than anything else. Stella! Stella! Anyway.
What was that?
That's Marlon Brando in Streetcar Named Desire.
Just do it again.
Stella!
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I can do the other ones. I'm Blanche. Blanche Dubois. I've always relied on the... You're not the gentleman caller I expected. Actually, that's not as good as the Brando, I admit. But anyway, so...
You do camp very well,
though. To me, thank you. To me, he is, proper old-school movie star. And the interesting thing about watching Death and Life of Charlie Sinclair is, firstly, a couple of weeks ago, my daughter wanted to go and see a film in the cinema. And actually, the only thing that was on offer to her, because she'd already gone to see Scott Pilgrim versus the World, was Marmaduke. That was it. It is true that there is a whole section of the cinema-going audience which has been largely neglected until fairly recently, which is one of the reasons I like the Twilight movies so much, because it's great to have proper movies that actually, 12-year-old boys, 13-year-olds, Transformers movies wherever you look, but there isn't so much for 12-year-old girls. The other thing about it is that when you consider the potential mawkishness of the project, which is there's older brother, younger brother, tragic loss, then he goes out, into the woods, meets the ghost of the younger brother, and the central plot device then is, can Charlie St. Cloud move on and start having a relationship with somebody else, or will that mean that his relationship with his brother somehow falls apart? I mean, it's potentially incredibly mawkish. And what's surprising about the film, and I understand entirely, that it's very easy to mock, is that it's nothing like as mawkish as it could be. In fact, despite the fact that it obviously flirts with pathos, it's a lot more interesting than it looks like from the outside. And there are moments when you think, oh blimey, the plot is going to go all over the place. I can see how this is going to work out. They're attempting to do the Twilight thing when there's a sort of kissing scene in a graveyard, which is a little bit gothy, and therefore it's going to be, we're playing to the Twilight market. But for most of the film, it was peculiar in that it was nothing like as mawkish or terrible or, unacceptable as people would think from the trailer. But also what was interesting was watching it in a room full of middle-aged male critics who were sneering and blah, blah, oh, yeah, blah-dee, blah-dee, blah. But afterwards came out, spoke to a couple of them, went, actually, that really wasn't bad, was it? They went, well, it was better than much better than we expected. And the reason it's better than we expected is that it's directed with much more edge than you would have thought from that project, because it's written in a way which does not treat its audience as if they're completely stupid. And most importantly, because Zac Efron is an interesting, attractive in the best sense of the word, enigmatic, charismatic screen presence. And frankly, I liked it, and I think that it's for its target audience, it will play well. It does a very good job of reconciling itself and dealing with issues of life and death in a way which is obviously popcorn friendly and fluffy, but was nothing like as stupid as it potentially could have been. And for heaven's sake, in a market in which the 12-year-old girl market is sorely underserved, I thought it was really quite fine.
Is it a rather poor title?
The Death and Life of Charlie Sinclair.
Quite an off-putting title.
Well, it's rather like the tall blonde man with one dark shoe, whatever. I mean, yes, no.
He went up a mountain.
With the Englishman who went up a Welshman and came down a Frenchman or whatever it was. Yeah, it doesn't trip off the tongue, but Charlie St. Cloud is what you see on all the posters. And I think you get over the title, it's fine.
And you do like Zac Efron.
I do like Zac Efron. I think he's a really, really, genuinely proper old-school movie star.
A text in from Nick in Cheltenham. I'm going to see Mark in Cheltenham. That's the only one we've had, though.
Thanks for that.
Hugh Evans says, Mr. Kermode, in last week's show, you were asked to offer an opinion about the release of Star Wars in 3D.
Yeah, I think I did offer an opinion about it.
Given that we know how Mark feels about both topics, I thought the combination would have created a lashback so colossal that even the good folk of Maya could have
Can't
seen it coming.
Can't be bothered.
As said rant was not forthcoming, I created a new phrase for the glossary, Kermodian Ranty Climax. For use when a rant is expected by listeners but fails to appear. So that's what it was.
Can't
last
be
week.
Done to order. I mean, the thing is, how bothered can you get about, oh, George Lucas is going to roll out the Star Wars movies in yet another...
John,
here's a good one.
What?
How does Darth Vader know what Luke Skywalker's getting for Christmas? He felt his presence. Yeah, very good.
Who told you that?
My son.
Very good. And did you laugh?
Yes, and again just then.
We're talking about Zac Efron, and this from our audience here. Sir, what's your name? Gentleman in the glasses.
My name's Nick.
You from round the corner?
No, I'm from Woodford in East London. Okay. I just wanted to say that I agree with Mark's point about Zac Efron, and I can see him taking a career trajectory that'd be very similar to John Travolta's, and in the way that I really enjoyed Travolta's performance in the remake of Taking of Pelham 123, I can see Zac Efron going on to Meteor, and more prominent roles that will give him more of a critical favour.
If he ends up starring in Battlefield Earth,
oh, that's
he's all, it's all over, frankly.
It's 11 minutes to 4. What else is new, Mark?
Mr. Nice, in which Reese Ifans... Is it Ifans or Ifans?
Reese Ifans.
As he said it. Stars as Howard Marks, who, by his own admission and by legal, I think, is a drug dealer, part-time spy, now turned loose stand-up performer. So the story is, I mean, it's based on a true story. It's actually based on his own memoir. Grows up in Wales, gets placed in Oxford, goes to Oxford. Success goes completely to his head. Next thing you know, he gets involved in drug dealing, gets involved with the IRA. He's running drugs around the world. He's being loose and, a crazed womanizer, but has a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card because at some point early on, he is sort of recruited, possibly as a British spy. Here's a clip.
Are you asking me to be a spy?
Howard, I haven't just turned up on your doorstep without doing my research. Will you help us?
How can I help you?
We need people to gather information for us.
You're a spy.
Howard, keep it down. This is not a James Bond movie.
Well, it certainly feels like it. Are you recruiting me? You're asking me to be a member of MI6?
Well, the government doesn't ever officially acknowledge the existence of what you call MI6. However, we do need to keep abreast of things, and we do employ a loose network of people who do things for us. You travel in circles we can't penetrate. We just might need your help. Sort of a patriotic thing, old chap.
And I imagine this would give me a certain amount of protection.
So, on the one hand, on the good side, what you have is Reese. I mean, it's not that much of a stretch, right? Reese Ifans is playing a intoxicated, womanizing vagabond Lothario. Who
is
falls
that what he does?
Well, that's what he plays. And you think, yeah, and he's Welsh. And how hard is that going to be? But did any of you see that thing when he played Peter Cook in Not Only But Also on television, which I actually thought was a brilliant performance, a really, really well-judged performance. And what he does here, I mean, it's interesting. If you compare what he does here to what, for example, Michael Sheen does when he's playing Tony Blair, or when he's playing Brian Clough, or you know, any of those things. There's that whole thing about you don't imitate somebody. What you do is you do a performance. It's not an impression. It's a proper performance. And actually, I think Reese Ifan's central performance is very fine. Chloe Savini is his long-suffering partner. He spends an awful lot of the film saying, please don't do this. Please stop the drug trafficking. Please stop doing it. With whom one has an awful lot of sympathy, although she does sort of somewhat struggle with the accent. And Christian Mackay is there, who was great in Me and Orson Welles, which is the Zac Efron film before, actually, in which I thought Zac Efron also did very, very well. The problem with it is it's directed by Bernard Rose, who directed Candyman, Ivan's Ecstasy, Kreutzer Sonata. And the problem with the film is that because it's essentially based on Marx's own version of his own story, it is, by its very nature, hagiographic. I mean, it's what it's saying to us is he's a lovable character, he's a lovable rogue. Yes, he's an international, you know, drugs, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, hey, he's on the right side. And it requires an awful lot of sympathy to go, yeah, fine, of course, everything's lovely. Because when people are saying, you know, you really shouldn't be doing this. No, you really shouldn't be doing this. You know, genuinely, you really probably shouldn't be doing this. There's a voice that's been going, yeah, no, you shouldn't be doing this. How long have I been here? The other thing is that there's a strange device in it in which the characters are put into period setting by taking old film of, you know, of streets in the 1960s and digitally putting them into it. And I genuinely couldn't understand whether the effect of them being digitally placed into the old footage was creaky on purpose in a way that kind of made it look like some strange performance piece. I mean, you think, for example, of Andy Serkis in Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, which the whole thing is staged as a sort of cabaret performance. They've got those animated sequences that are deliberately unnatural, or whether it actually just wasn't that good. I think what you have in the end is a very good performance by Reese Ifans. You have some fairly solid support. You've got David Thewlis playing this incredibly unpleasant, loud, foul, really horrible IRA guy who's, you know, spouts one thing but behaves in another. When actually David Thewlis, when he's on screen, pretty much threatens to dominate the screen and to knock Reese Ifans out of the central position. But in the end, the story is in love with its subject matter, which is kind of unsurprising, isn't as interesting as the extraordinary details of the story would seem to imply, and is, I hate to say it, a television movie, in a way that, oddly enough, the television movie not only but also wasn't. It's, you go and see it for Reese Ifans' performance. You don't go and see it, I think, as a brilliant piece of cinema. And if you have any sense that actually, you know, doing all this stuff may not be the most brilliant thing to do in the whole world, your patience will wear thin.
It's 3:54. We have about 5 minutes left. A text just in from Adam in Brighton. I'm not going to see Mark in Cheltenham. So, but you don't care.
Yes, we've got a seat free now, apparently, in that case. So anyone near Cheltenham, make your way down there.
Stephen McNeil, the good doctor, is often right, but his statements regarding the use of prepositions is wrong. This is a subject that will not die. Prepositions have been used at the end of sentences for centuries. It is often the case that to do otherwise sounds dreadfully formal and in some cases unavoidable. An example would be, a Friday without a Commodian rant does not bear thinking about. I am less concerned with split infinitives, as I like Star Trek. It has the most famous one of all. I do, however, find myself shouting, Lee, to complete the sentences of people who say things like, why do you want that car so bad?
Lee.
Exactly. Are you that kind of person?
No.
I think you are. I think you've proved over the last couple of weeks that you clearly are. John, on this, it's 8:30 in the morning. I'm just listening to your fine podcast from the 24th September. And after the good doctor referenced the poster at Teesside Airport, which stated, if it's happening, it's happening in Stockton-on-Tees, that poster, I have to tell you, couldn't be more wrong. And this is the reason why you bypassed here. I assume driving without stopping on your way to Newcastle for Septemberfest. Something I can't fault you on for doing. If you ever want to see what's not happening in Stockton-on-Tees, feel free to visit. Anyway, so you know, he's just reassuring you that when you passed on through, you probably got it right. With apologies to everyone in Stockton-on-Tees. You're probably about to say movie of the week.
Well, can I very quickly tell you about Restrepo, which is this documentary set in Afghanistan's Korangal Valley, in which basically what happens is you've got a group of soldiers in this valley, and it's the documentary is shot incredibly sort of up close and personal. The Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Young, the people who made it, are right in there with them. What happens at the very beginning of the film is we're introduced to this character, Doc Restrepo. He loses his life very, very early on, and they then have to set up an encampment, which they then refer to as Restrepo, in honour of their fallen friend. And what you have is this really quite extraordinary portrait of a group of people in a circumstance which is genuinely terrifying and seems to be playing out right in front of you, done, as I said, in very, very close contact documentary filmmaking that seems to be unobtrusive and seems to catch them really as they are. And I was talking before about the Oliver Stone film Platoon, in which the central idea of it is that when you're in that situation, it's not the global effect of the situation, it's to do with the people with you, it's to do with a group of people banding together in terrifying circumstances. And what you get from this is, on the one hand, you see an extraordinary ground's eye view of that kind of conflict. So they are meeting with the local elders and attempting to win over their hearts and minds, but actually fighting a losing battle. You see helicopters going overhead, and there's this really stark contrast between what it must be like being in a helicopter and what it's like being down on the ground. You see them getting involved in and the aftermath of terrible skirmishes in which they are under fire in ways which are genuinely terrifying, and there is horrifying loss of life. And what you get from it is, firstly, this portrait of people who are incredibly young under circumstances which are just unimaginable. Also, something which seems to be very honest about it doesn't seem to be mediated. It's not like, you know, news reports about these kind of things. What you get is a real... I mean, people have described it to some extent as being like a real-life Hurt Locker, but that actually lends an air of artifice to it, which I think is unfair to the project. You come out of it feeling that you've genuinely witnessed some extraordinary events with nothing but admiration for the people in these circumstances, these incredibly young people in these mind-boggling circumstances. It's quite a tough watch. I mean, it's genuinely sort of fairly grueling. And it does give you that sense that if this is what it's like, even observing this kind of, you know, this kind of interaction, it's unimaginable what it must be like in being in it. Now, the piece is interspersed with interviews in which the soldiers talk about their experiences later on. And one of the things that they say is, the problem is nobody knows what to do with this because we've been through these, you know, really unbelievable experiences. This all sort of recalls to some extent, you know, Vietnam. And now people don't know what to do with it. There is a point to the film, which is you have to find some way of dealing with people that have been through these appalling circumstances. But as a piece of documentary filmmaking, it was really quite astonishing. And it's had a lot of plaudits, and justifiably so. It's a really very, very interesting piece. And I would say it is probably film of the week.
And is it going to be something that you're going to struggle to try and find?
No, well, I was just looking to see whether, in fact, I think in Time Out, it is film of the week, which means that it probably is getting some. I was looking
Time
to,
Out being London's,
Time Out, but I was looking to see through the Phoenix catalogue. See, have you got Riz Restrepo showing it? No, it's not showing here, so you can't see it at the Phoenix. So therefore, yes, you will have to search it out.
So it'll be one of those things you have to hunt around a little bit for. So that would be Movie of the Week. And if you can't find it, of all the other films that you've done...
Death and Life of Charlie St. Cloud. Town Called Panic's pretty good. Wall Street Money Never Sleeps isn't really up to snuff.
Well, that was the podcast for this week. I personally thought it was very good. What was your favourite bit?
I loved the bit when we were in the Phoenix in East Finchley.
Well, the whole bit?
Yeah, the whole bit.
Which member of the audience here has been your favourite? As you've looked out, have you thought he or she is a really nice person?
I quite like the lady that you bullied into having something to say about the film when she didn't want to say anything. So, yeah. Do you want to say anything? No. Go on. No. Think of something. Really don't want to.
Annie from Edinburgh was very nice, wasn't she?
She was. Yeah, very nice.
Yeah.
And the gentleman who said that the best thing about Shia LaBeouf was that he apologised for one of his movies. That was quite good. Okay.
But in general, they were all pretty good, weren't they?
Yeah, they were good.
Yeah.
Can I go now? Because I have places to be.
Yeah, okay. That's the end of the podcast. Thanks for listening.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.